This morning, we are going to be looking at the subject of edification. My understanding of the assignment is we're supposed to examine the example given to us in the scriptures of how a congregation was to be edified within the assembly, within the gathering of the saints. We'll certainly get there, but I do want to start off a little bit broader. We're first going to look at the definition of the word edification or to edify. And then we'll work through how it fits within the context of the working and the function and the purpose, really, of the church. And from there, we'll get into the edification of the assembly and examine the New Testament example that we are given on how to structure our teaching and our edification within the service. So first of all, let's define this word, edification. It's not really a word that's used much in our day-to-day vernacular. I don't think I've ever left a meeting at work or anything and heard somebody say, well, that was edifying, possibly because it's never actually happened. But in anyways, you don't hear people use that word in our day-to-day lives. At least I don't. Maybe you have, but I haven't. And while we all may have an understanding generally what it means, I think looking at the Greek word for a few minutes this morning and how it's used throughout the New Testament can be informative in looking at or understanding what God was trying to convey with his use of the word and its work and function within the church. The Greek word that is translated edify a handful of times in the New Testament is found many more times translated as built or building elsewhere in the New Testament. In fact, throughout the gospel messages, anytime you see the Greek word that's translated edify, that's translated that way maybe in like the Pauline epistles, anytime it's used in the Gospels, it's actually in the word of built or building or, built or building. For instance, in Matthew chapter 7, when Jesus is talking about or contrasting the wise man against the foolish man, the wise man built his house upon the rock, the foolish man built his house upon the sand. That word built is actually the Greek word that's translated edify in other passages in the scriptures. In fact, in the 31 times it's used in Matthew through Acts, 30 of those times, it's referring to either a building or the process of building things. Towers, tombs, houses, barns, the temples are all built. They're edified in the gospel and in the Acts of the Apostles. The word does not just mean a building, but it also connotates a process or a system in putting together a building. You know, when we think about building a home, for instance, it should elicit in our minds an image of a process. And while we may not all understand the process in building a home, we know the basics, right? You lay a foundation, you put up the walls, you add a roof to that, right? There's a process in putting that building up. And when we talk about this process, we're going for what the process is supposed to do is create a nice, strong structure, something that's built to withstand the elements of the world, right? Something that is useful to a purpose, something that you can function inside and have it protect you from the outward elements. It's a structure with a purpose. And so when we use the word edify, right, it should elicit the same type of meaning because it means the same thing. One can say that the wise man edified his house upon the rock. And I'll reiterate, that's important to understand because God takes this word that's translated oftentimes as building or built, and he turns it into a spiritual concept to describe the working and functioning of the church and its members. There's a notable shift that actually happens in Acts chapter 9 and 31 when this concept of building begins to get applied to the church and the members of the church. And in that verse, we read, "Then the churches throughout Judea, Galilee, and Samaria had peace and were edified. And walking in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit, they were multiplied." Now we're reading about the church being edified. And that does not mean that the church went through and built up buildings to meet in. It means that just as a building starts with a foundation and grows from there into something strong and useful and purposeful, the church had received its foundation in Jesus Christ and was itself now growing in spiritual maturity and into something strong, useful, and purposeful for the work of the Lord. Their faith is increasing, their conviction in the truth is increasing, their love for one another is increasing. And from really here on, throughout the rest of the New Testament, the word edified is used frequently with a spiritual meaning. At times, it's used to describe the church itself, right, and describing the church as a building. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 9 is one example where it reads, "For we are God's fellow worker, you are God's field, you are God's building." Right? There is that Greek word to edify, building. The word building is the same Greek word translated as edify in many different places. And Paul goes on in those verses to describe himself and others as builders working to add to the foundation of faith. So again, you can have the idea of a process or the concept of a process being elicited in his language there. More frequently, though, the word is used to describe the work of the church in edifying one another. And this is the process by which members of the church work to build up one another, build upon one another. And this is where that base definition comes to mind, because now instead of edifying a physical structure, we are edifying a spiritual structure. We are working to create in one another stable spiritual structures that are able to withstand temptations and false teachings, and that are useful to the work of the Lord and to His church. And we find in the Scriptures that this is one of the main functions of the church, is to edify its members, to grow its members. Ephesians chapter 4 through chapter 4, verses 17 through 16 makes this point very clearly. Let's turn over there. We're going to spend a couple minutes here. And I'm actually going to take the time to read this passage. So we're in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 7 through 16. "But to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gifts. Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. Now this, he ascended, what does it mean but that he also first descended into the lower parts of the earth? He who descended is the one who ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. And he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, so we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking of the truth in love may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love." This passage is essential in understanding the purpose and the work of the church. The design that God ordained for the church is here for a reason. It describes a process where God grants the church gifts or talents or skills or abilities that equip people for the work of the church and to edify the body of Christ to growth. And these are not all miraculous gifts in nature. The church requires people who can shepherd the flock or teach the word. And God provides people who are capable of doing these tasks. And within this passage, we see a circular pattern in the church, that God first grants these abilities, the people use these abilities to equip others for the work of the church. And what are those people supposed to use those things that they've been equipped with now? To then again go and equip people for the work of the church, for the service, and also for the maintenance of doctrine and truth. And teaching is going to be a part of this, in establishing people in faith and to keep them from being tossed around by false doctrine, to speaking of truth and love for growth. And so there's this cycle by which church members work to build up others so that they themselves may become productive workers in the church who then go to equip others. It is a circular pattern. The truth is taught so people's faith is strong, so they are equipped for the work of the ministry, which in part is to teach the truth themselves so that the faith of others becomes stronger. And this is important to understand because it should inform so much of what we do and so much of what we do in the services and in the work of the church. We are working to equip one another, to equip others who will then be able to go and equip others themselves. And every member has a part in this process, and that's something that comes out in a lot of different scriptures. In a similar passage over in Romans chapter 12, verses 3 through 8, Paul again writes of God granting people with abilities to perform certain functions of the church. And Britt talked about this passage at a bit more length a couple weeks ago. We'll just touch on it here. But we find in verse 3 of that chapter, and this is Romans 12, that Paul tells us to think soberly of ourselves. So we're not drunk with pride, but we take a measured look at ourselves to see what kind of function we can serve in the church. And it's very clear that whatever it is that we find, whatever it is that we find that God has given us, the natural talents or abilities that we have, that we are to use that gifting for the benefit of one another. Verse 6 says, "Having then gifts differing according to the grace given to us, let us use them." And that message is loud and clear there. Use your gifts. God has given them to you for the work and the function of the body. This is your part in this process. And as we continue to talk about edification, what I want to take away from these couple of passages is, first of all, that the church's purpose is to edify itself. The purpose of each congregation is to edify itself. And as members, we are to examine ourselves to find our place in that process and use those gifts in which God has given us. All right, here in a second, we're going to talk about how this specifically is done in the assembly. But before I get to that, does anybody have anything they want to add or any questions that they have? Okay, if not, let's turn over to 1 Corinthians 14, please. One of the ways that these gifts are used to edify and strengthen one another is in the assembly. And this is clearly brought out in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, this chapter. And just as Ephesians 4 is an excellent passage to really understand the work and the function of the church, or to help in that understanding, 1 Corinthians 14 is an excellent passage to understand the working and the purpose of our assemblies together. It informs so much for us. And I do want to, there is some context that's necessary to get into before I get into this too much, and I'll try to provide that fairly quickly here. So in chapter 14, Paul is trying to get the Corinthian brethren to have a more correct view of spiritual gifts. And when he's talking about spiritual gifts in this particular passage, he is talking about miraculous gifts. A couple that he mentions the most in this passage are speaking in tongues and prophecies. And these miraculous gifts were given to the early church to help them, firstly, to demonstrate Christ, but also to fill that gap that existed with no New Testament. These people didn't have the New Testament scriptures to draw on. And so they were given these things to know what to preach so that the truth would be established. Now, we don't have these miraculous gifts in this measure anymore. These gifts were imparted by the laying on of hands of the apostles. And so once the apostles were gone, then these gifts would have slowly faded out as those who had been given them by the apostles had passed away. Now, I realize that's a pretty quick explanation of what's going on here, but I don't really have time to build much more of that out. But as we're talking about these gifts, or we're reading about these gifts here, the thing to take away, though, is that the Lord is trying to edify by these gifts, and that is ultimately the function that we are trying to perform here in our services. And he talks mostly about speaking in tongues and prophecies. And those gifts are ultimately given for instruction or edification of others. Tongues required an interpreter for others to understand and be edified by the speakers. And that's one thing that Paul makes very clear in this passage. Prophets, who I believe were inspired teachers to make up for their lack of New Testament scriptures, were able to edify one another with their words. And I actually equate that process, or that the prophesying with teaching from the Word of God. Someone who is teaching would be filling this role of prophecy in our modern-day assemblies. And that's consistent with the meaning of the word, too. A prophet isn't one who just divinely inspired directly from God. It's also someone who is a messenger on his behalf. And we're speaking from the word. That's exactly what we are. But despite many of these activities in this chapter being miraculously inspired, there is still a tremendous amount that we can learn from this passage. And I just want to pull out a few things that are relevant to our class this morning. First of all, that all things in the assembly are to be done for edification. The second thing I want to pull out of this morning is that multiple people were responsible for this edification, for edifying the body. There wasn't one designated person whose job it was to edify. And third, Paul desires, his desire was for people to seek their involvement in the assembly, specifically to aspire to be teachers. Now, the first two of these points really comes out in verses 26 through 31. So let's drop down there and read these few verses here. So we're in 1 Corinthians 14, 26 through 31. "How is it then, brethren, whenever you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation, let all things be done for edification. If anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be two or three, or at most three, each in turn, and let one interpret. But if there is no interpreter, let him keep silent in the church, and let him speak to himself and to God. Let two or three prophets speak, and let the others judge. But if anyone is revealed to another who sits by, let the first keep silent. For you can all prophesy one by one, that you may all learn and all be encouraged. So we see the very first point there in the first verse of that passage, there in verse 26, that all things in the assembly are to be done for edification. Everything that we do here has that purpose to that. Whoever is leading the study, the songs, the Lord's Supper, a prayer, a reading, a lesson is working to build or should be working to build up others. Now, there's certainly other purposes going on there. When we sing, it's not just for edification. It's also for praise to God. When we have the Lord's Supper, it's not just for edification. We're remembering Christ. We're proclaiming his death one to another. There's other purposes there. But alongside with that is always edification, the work to build one another up. It should also be what we seek when we come here, to be edified, to listen for things to build us up. If the truth is being taught, if Scripture is being provided, the onus is on us that that occurs, that that building up happens. We choose how we receive the word, and this is a point we'll come back to later on, time permitting. The second point also comes out in these verses, because what we have exemplified here is the participation of many members. He says there in verse 26, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. That shows that you have multiple members participating in this process. In verse 27, you even see him talking about the number of people to participate, right? If there's somebody speaking in tongues, two or three. If there's no interpreter, of course, none. But then with prophets, allow two or three to speak. This is done by a multiplicity of people, not just one. And the third point that we have here is that Paul wants people to seek to prophesy, to seek to teach. And this comes out primarily in the first five verses of this chapter, but also in other places as well. In verse 1 of chapter 14, it says, pursue love and desire spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. And he goes on to say that this is because he who prophesies edifies the body. He builds up the body. And he contrasts this with someone who is speaking in tongues without an interpreter. He's saying that even though that might be showy and impressive to watch, it only edifies the speaker. It does nothing for the body. That's why he says in verse 5, I wish you all spoke with tongues, but even more that you prophesied. He wanted people to involve themselves in practices that were for the edification of the church. So the picture and example that we receive in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 is an assembly where you have multiple people who are using their talents for the edification of the church. And this is consistent with what we find in other passages as well. We have seen in Ephesians chapter 4 how God has given gifts to the church, gifts of teaching for one, to edify the body. And the expectation in those verses is that the individuals would use those gifts in the church to impart those abilities to others so that they may do the same one day. We've seen in Romans chapter 12 God's desire for each of us to look at what he has given us for talents and to use those things for the growth of the body. And now we have Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 telling the brethren to pursue the talents to edify the body, including teaching. There's also a couple other scriptures that have similar connotations. Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, in all things you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these things to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. And again, you have in that verse this idea of this cycle that's a pair in the church. You go and teach these things to others so that they may be able to teach these things. The writer of Hebrews in chapter 5, he criticized the people that he was writing to. And what was his criticism of them there? His criticism of them there was that they were not yet teachers. They had not grown to be able to be teachers themselves. He tells them that they ought to be teachers. And again, this cycle of teaching, Paul doesn't want to explain these elementary principles again to them because he wants them to be explaining it to other people. And when you put all this together, I hope this paints the picture of why we have chosen as a congregation to function as the way we do. This is why we don't have a designated teacher. This is why the men from the congregation take it upon themselves to teach and to preach in the assembly. That is how God had the church function. That is how the early church functioned. This was the example he provided us. He's given us these gifts in the church, and while they're no longer miraculous in nature, they are obvious in their existence. You can see the varying talents and the gifts that God has given the church for its edification, and He has the expectation that we use them to that purpose. We have the tools within ourselves to edify ourselves. Paul expressed this confidence in the Roman brethren when he said in Romans chapter 15 and verse 14, "Now I myself am confident concerning you, my brethren, that you are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, and also able to admonish one another." You are able, you are equipped to do this work. And this is the purpose, or part of the purpose of the church. It is the members in the congregation's responsibility to teach the church. It is their purpose to forward that cycle. And we have been a part of this congregation, and for those of you who have been a part of this congregation, you've seen this play out over your lifetime, perhaps. You know, I look at many of you who are in the generation before me, and I know that my grandparents built many of you up, helped equip you for the work of the church. And I obviously didn't see that, but I know it because you've told me that. You've told me that. They use their God-given talents to promote growth of God, of your God-given talents, so that you could promote the growth of my generation's God-given talents. And we should be spending those investing in the next brethren so that cycle keeps moving. That is the way the church is supposed to work. And part of that is done here in our assemblies, working together, edifying one another, encouraging one another, admonishing one another, so that the work of the Lord can continue in the work of the church that continue. And that is what God has outlined for us. All right, I'm going to pause here. Does anybody have any questions or comments to add to this before we move on? We got one with Shane. Do we have people with microphones over here? We got Shane and we got Gerald.
Appreciate your thoughts, Blake. A couple of things that kind of went through my mind. Going back to the passage you looked at first in Ephesians, you know, there in like, 11, 12, and 13, it's talking about the various roles that people have with evangelists and apostles and things like that. Yeah. And so it's kind of what is going on. And then verse 14 and 15, it gets into why it's going on, and it says that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro, and then in verse 15 that we could speak the truth. So there's kind of an individual responsibility that we take that teaching, and one, we grow roots ourselves, and then we're able to, as you said, the cycle. And you know, nothing made me more cognizant of that cycle than having children. And the analogy that I've used is just the old-fashioned like fire brigade. And it's like, I feel like one generation is just taking the bucket from the previous generation, and their job is just to pass it along to the next and spill as little water as possible.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. Gerald?
Just before the 1 Corinthians 14 passage that you spent some time on, back in 1 Corinthians 12, I think we're given insight about how that process of working together to be a body occurs. And one thing that jumped out at me there is how important it is that we value, that we respect the contribution of each person. There's no room for envy or jealousy over what roles that you take or what talents that you have. Everyone is important, and we need to look for the good in other people and lift them up so that they can do their job and they can feel appreciated when they do their job. Colossians, the second chapter, tells us that when that body is put together, it's knit together in love. Yeah. That's what holds the body together.
I think we're teeing you up, Steve. Is that true? I think we're teeing you up. Yeah. All right. Thank you for the comments. Same thing, we got Alan over here.
Yeah. How does that meld? How do you meld that then with James, the third chapter, the first verse, where not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness?
Yeah, it is interesting that you have this comment by Paul, and I was actually going to bring up that passage here in a bit, but you have this comment by Paul. He's encouraging people to be teachers. I've always taken the James passage as being one of a warning to teachers that you need to be cautious, right? And you need to approach teaching cautiously because you are going to have, you are taking on a very important role, and you can mislead people, obviously, if you're not preaching the truth. So I've always seen that as an admonishment of being cautious as being a teacher, and not necessarily just a pure discouragement of being teacher and limiting our teachers. Does anybody else have a comment on that? Rick does. Peter. Okay.
In 1 Peter, you're talking about edifying or building up. It 1 Peter, the second chapter, verse 4, starting with verse 4, Peter talks about us being living stones and being built up a spiritual house. And there it says a holy priesthood. So the idea of us being a priesthood, that's what God wanted all along, is for us to involve ourselves that way. I think for his people to involve themselves that way, to offer up spiritual sacrifices up to God through Jesus Christ. So I think the idea of us being a priesthood, that's what that was the responsibility of the priesthood, is to convey to the people the word of God. So.
Going back to the James 3 passage for a minute, this is not the only place where something is mentioned like a command, even though we know that it's not that simple. For example, Matthew chapter 7, during the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "Do not judge." But then he immediately follows it up with, "Lest you be judged," and explains that he's not saying don't judge, he's explaining the consequences of judging. With the judgment you judge, it will be measured back to you. So maybe something similar is going on in James chapter 3.
Well, then you also think about what his message is in the verses following that comment in James chapter 3. That whole passage is about the tongue and how it can really affect people, and it can have the ability to build people up or tear people down. And so I've always taken that within that context to be a cautionary of, if you're going to be a teacher, you have to be cautious about using your tongue. And so do not go into teaching flippantly. Like, go into it, it's a serious thing, and you need to go into it with caution and understand that the things that you are going to say will have a consequence. Yeah, we've got Dave back here.
Yeah, Blake, you mentioned the 12th chapter of Romans. And I was thinking about back up in the third verse of that there. And the very latter part of that third verse, it says, "As God dealt to every man the measure of faith." That's the ability that God gives each and every one of us, whether it's the same thing or a different thing. And we all know that. But the problem is, are we satisfied with that? Or should we just be satisfied with that, or should we try to excel from that?
Excel from what God has granted us?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of what he's saying there when he's telling us to use them is you know, you may have the talent, you know, a natural affinity for teaching or for leadership or for caring for others, but, you know, there is always a way that you can better that work, and you should be bettering that work when you use them, right? To become, you know, if you're teaching, to try to become a more effective communicator. If you're leading, trying to, you know, understand people better. Like, I think you have a responsibility to take the gifts that God has given you and to build upon your ability to execute them. Is that what you're asking? Yeah. Yeah, I think you have the responsibility to do that. And I think that's really what that passage is talking about, is that you have been given something, right? And you need to work to excel at that. And I guess that kind of goes back to the point with teaching, right? In all those passages, he brings up teaching as one of the gifts that he has given. And so that's out there. And if you have that, I think the onus on you is to build that ability, right? So I think you have to contrast those things, not contrast, but complement those things with what we see like in James chapter 3. Anybody have any additional comments, Dan?
We're talking about men's role in edifying the church. What is a woman's role in edifying the church?
Well, I think when you look at the word edify, it's a very broad term. Okay, to edify is to build up. All right, and there, whatever you are doing to help somebody build up their faith, to help them become stronger in their walk for Christ, to help them with dealing with the temptations of the world, anything that you're doing to help with that, I think is edification, right? So, as whether it's a woman or a man or whatever, whatever work goes to that, whether that's just an encouraging word, whether that's teaching in classes downstairs, whether that's, you know, talking about the scriptures with a brother or a sister, whether that's going over and encouraging them during a difficult time. I think that there are just a multiplicity of ways that you can edify people, because it's not a specific task or it's not a specific thing that we're trying to do. We're just trying to help one another become stronger in the Lord, right? So that we're not tossed to and fro by every wave of doctrine, so that we're more convicted in the truth, okay? So there are so many ways that we can edify one another. And really, you know, my assignment here this morning was to more talk specifically about the assembly, but edification goes way beyond that. It goes way beyond just what we're doing here. In fact, I think that while this is obviously a critical component of it, it's a very small part of what we should be doing in our day-to-day lives to really edify one another. Does that answer your question? Does anybody else want to put any input into that? We've got two things, Bill, and then we got Maura here.
You hit it right there at the end, but if this is the only place we edify, we are missing the lion's share of the places we should be edifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just what we have going on here. We look around us, this beautiful, most important job of godly mothering. Bringing up faithful offspring.
Amen. Right, any other comments? Okay, I've got about 8 minutes left. Let me see kind of what I want to do here. All right. Well, when we look at the religious world around us, the model that we practice here is not what we see practice in a lot of other places. In most places, most religious organizations, we find that the teaching and other parts of the service are led by one or a handful of designated people. And in most cases, these are individuals who have received additional training outside of the church to receive a degree or a certification from a teaching institution. That is the norm of what you see. And it's so much the norm that in my experience, people are somewhat surprised when they hear about the way that we go about our assemblies here and our teaching here. Over the years, I've had a lot of interactions with people who, when I say I'm speaking at church, they ask if I'm on staff or if I'm a minister or a preacher. And when I tell them about how it is that we do here, that the men share this responsibility in teaching, I usually get a comment of, well, that's interesting. You know, it's a very foreign concept to most people. And I think that's important to recognize as we talk to people or maybe even amongst one another, that most people would not think of a different way or even consider that the current approach seen across the religious landscape is not really what's even exemplified in the early church. We don't see a model of that in the early church. It's not one that's given there. But to most people, this is just the way that it's done, and they wouldn't think about doing it any other way. And not only are people used to this, I think also it follows our cultural thinking very closely as well. You know, the way we view a qualifying process. You know, our professionals, the experts, go to universities to receive education and training to receive a degree. Our certification demonstrates that they are qualified for a role. And in many cases, that's a really good thing. You know, we want our nurses, our doctors, our engineers, our lawyers to have gone through an education and have something to show that they are qualified to do their work. But that mode of thinking has, in a way, been transferred to the church. If you're going to be a teacher, you go to seminary, you earn a theology degree, you become a certified minister, this is how you become qualified to be a leader in a congregation. And that is the way that a lot of people, or most people out there, think about this. And this is where it becomes really important to recognize God's design and purpose for the church. In Ephesians 4, when it's talking about the gifts of the body being given to equip others so they might equip others, the writer of Hebrews, with his expectation that those who he taught should now be teachers. Paul encouraging the brethren in Corinth to all prophesy. Paul encouraging us in Romans chapter 12 to find our gifts and use them. Paul telling Timothy to teach others so that they may become teachers. This is the work and the function of the church. The church is designed and purposed for the raising up of teachers. The members are to be working towards teaching themselves, right? If they reflect soberly upon their gifts and find that that is part of their gifting. That is the function and the purpose of the church. And in a lot of places, that's kind of been removed from the church, where the educating of teachers isn't done through the church. And those teachers don't see it as their job to be training what is essentially going to be their replacement someday. So we need to consider that as we look at these other models that we find, that the model that we have in the church is one where you have a multiplicity of teachers, where you have multiple people who are doing this work and are educating one another and are working towards being effective teachers themselves. Anybody have any comments or questions? Just pause there before I make one other thing. Nick?
I would say that, you know, I come from a Catholic background, and when I first started going to the Church of Christ, that was my view of when I heard about a mutual edification church. I'm like, my first thought was, how can someone who's not gone through that college training be a teacher of the gospel? How are they going to spread the word as effectively as someone who has? Clearly, that was wrong. And if you look back, who did Jesus call? He didn't call educated men to spread his word. He called fishermen and other uneducated men.
Yeah. Well, and then how were those men ultimately educated? They were educated with Jesus Christ, right? And then they would go on and educate people through the church. And really, that isn't a foreign model, or it wasn't even a foreign model to them at the time. You know, the synagogues functioned in much of the same fashion that were there during the time of Christ. And you can look at the development of the synagogues over the 4 minutes. Is that what you're giving me? You can look at the development of the synagogues over the centuries leading up to the time of Christ, and you can see a very similar function. And I'm going to pause there for a second to see if anybody else has any other comments or questions before I get into that a little bit more. Dave?
Just one other thought. Like, in 1 Thessalonians, 4th chapter, and I think it is 11th verse, it talks about how to comfort yourselves together and edify one another. In other words, build each other up. And then he mentioned right at the very end of that verse, he says, even as you do. In other words, the early church was, this is how they was doing things, was exactly the same way.
Yeah. And it's really, if you look at church history as well, you can see that, and then you can see the seeds of centralized teaching begin to kind of formulate in the early second century, when you kind of see the model that becomes developed, where instead of having multiple elders and deacons, you have a bishop, and then multiple elders and deacons kind of underneath the bishop, and then the centralization of that teaching occurs then. But it wasn't part of the early church. It's something that occurred after the early church, and that really kind of man instituted, and now it's unfortunately the norm when God gave us something different, to a different model to use. Any other comments or questions? How much time do I got left? Do I got 2 minutes? 2.5? Wow. What do I do with 2.5 minutes? As you can see, I have more to say, but I have more than 2.5 minutes of things to say. I do, though, maybe I should just take this. Yeah, I have 2 minutes now. That's what I get for talking about how few minutes I have left, is now I have even less. I'll use this just a little bit to talk a little bit more about the synagogue here, because you have the Jews in the time leading up to Christ had developed a very similar system, and some people think that's God-inspired. I don't know whether or not that was inspired by God or if it was really just the Jewish people understanding the commandments that God had given them in Deuteronomy to teach their children and teach one another the law. And in the synagogue, you had a structure where you had, you didn't have a single teacher. You didn't even have a single leader. Any Jewish man could speak. And we see that play out in passages like in Luke chapter 4, when Jesus is handed the book of Isaiah and he reads a passage there and declares himself the anointed. And you also see that play out several times with Paul. You know, Paul's custom was to go to the synagogues on the Sabbath when he entered a city to start preaching the gospel. We see that in Acts chapter, it says that in Acts chapter 17. In Acts chapter 13, you actually have it recorded there that one of the leaders in the synagogue opened up the floor to other men to speak. And so you had this very model that was done there. And apparently, you know, it was effective in teaching these men what the truth was and what the Lord's law was, because you have people like Jesus who was, what was his occupation? He was a carpenter, right? He was a carpenter, and yet during a time when literacy would have been very low, right? among, you know, the general population. You have them hand a carpenter, and obviously he's the Son of God, he can read, but these people didn't understand him as such. But they hand the Son of God the book to read out loud to the congregation, right? These people were educated in the scriptures, and they taught one another in the scriptures. And that is what we saw. When we talk about Peter and John and some of the other apostles during that time period, they were uneducated men, as observed by the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 4 and verse 13, but we know that they had a knowledge of the old law and that they had been taught in those things and that they were likely literate. You know, Peter and John, we have books written by those men, and while maybe they were dictated, we know that John was told to write down what he saw in the book of Revelation. And so you really do see that work, and I bring that up because, not because I think that's an argument for it, but it just further brings out the point that even under the old law, and even if we go back to the Old Testament and we look at what God expects of his people, he expected his people to be teachers. He expected his people to be teachers. He wanted his people to be teachers. He wanted them to learn the law, to know it, to understand it, to know him and understand him. And as we look at the work and the function of our church and of the church in general, this is part of the way that we fulfill that. We fulfill what it is that God has outlined us for us to do. Anybody have anything else they want to say? All right. Oh, we got one over here, Gerald.
Blake, if we look at the ultimate purpose of the church in the world is to bring the gospel to the world, what better way than to have each member practiced in teaching the word of the Lord?
Yeah.
Not just sitting, not just listening, but practicing, telling and teaching other people about that good news. That makes us capable of going into the world and doing the same thing.
Yeah, and I think, and this is me reading between the lines, but when you look at this design and how it helps equip us for his work, it really does. You know, when you are a teacher in a congregation or when you have an active role in a congregation, that equips you to go out and better spread his gospel. It equips you to better serve your brothers and sisters. It equips you to be able to equip others, as we have there in Ephesians chapter 4. And so it really is a critical part of the way that we function, and we really need to make sure that we adhere to it and that we continue to practice it and that we do our best to excel at it, because if we want to function and work like God intended for the church to work, I think it's necessary. So, thank you.